Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
Politics in Japan get shaken up by a new party with an anti-immigrant agenda.
They have created a perception that they're being flooded with foreigners, and we have to stop them before we become like Europe or America.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the rise of the Sanseito Party and its rallying cry, Japanese People First. Also on the show, controversy over a massive hydropower dam being built in China.
Once it's built, it's a very low carbon source of electricity. It tends to be fairly inexpensive.
But those benefits are still 10 years away.
And a Mexican musician on U.S. fans turning out for her shows despite fears of immigration enforcement.
I felt so proud of being Mexican. It becomes a healing moment, you know?
All that today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for tuning in this Monday. We begin our show in Japan. Elections this weekend saw major gains for the far-right Sanseito Party. The results suggest that the once fringe nationalist party has gained significant mainstream traction and could be an electoral force going forward.
The party's platform is Japanese People First. And yes, there is a striking similarity to a slogan used by a certain political movement in the U.S. Japan's Sanseito Party actually began on YouTube in 2020, but 5 years later, after drumming up a base, it's definitely more than a social media craze.
That's party leader Sohei Kamiya at a recent rally telling people to get out and vote with a message that politics used to be boring, but now is getting interesting. Following this weekend's vote, the Sanseito Party occupies 15 seats in Japan's legislature.
Earlier today, I spoke with Jeffrey Hall. He teaches Japanese politics at Kanda University of International Studies, just outside Tokyo. He said Sohei Kamiya had an unusual path into politics.
Mr. Kamiya, he is a social media influencer, a former English teacher. He and other social media influencers in 2020 came together to create this Sanseito Party. You could call it the Do Your Own Research Party because they're a party that believes in finding your own truth on the internet. And the truth is the truth that they present on their YouTube channel, not what you see in the mainstream media or in the newspapers. And so when the COVID pandemic hit, they really were able to grow in size by being a conspiracy party. It took 5 years of hard work by Mr. Kamiya and his supporters. And finally, in this election, they have stepped out onto the national stage and really grown at a pace that has shocked the mainstream media.
So the governing party lost ground, Jeffrey, and the smaller far-right party made notable gains. What were the issues driving that shift?
There has been years of dissatisfaction with the ruling LDP, which is a conservative party. It's a conservative party that has ruled the country for most of the last 70 years. But for the last 10 years, it has been in a sort of malaise. Japan's economy hasn't really grown very much. Wages haven't increased very much. And then in the last year, rice prices doubled. There's been inflation in various products. If you go to the grocery store, they're going up in price. And the government, meanwhile, had been pursuing an immigration policy that it sort of hid from the public. It didn't call it immigration. It called it talented workers, even though a lot of these workers were farm workers or factory workers. They were presenting it as skilled laborers who are needed for skilled industries. I think a lot of Japanese voters thought that they were getting engineers and things like that. And so 1 million new foreigners came into the country in the last 10 years, and this created an opening for this far-right party to attack the LDP during this election. And claim that foreigners are being treated better than Japanese in this country, hence the slogan, Japanese people first.
Finding your own truth. I mean, that sounds ripe for disinformation and, frankly, lies. When San Saito first started on YouTube, like, what were they saying to their viewers?
You can probably look up almost any Western or American conspiracy theory that's popular on the internet, and San Saito has imported some variant of that, whether it be the deep state or the vaccines and Dr. Fauci or other things. They also believe that grain or wheat is a conspiracy by the United States and globalists to poison the Japanese stomach and cause cancer. They think people should eat rice instead.
Are they still saying that?
They have disavowed it, but as early as last year, they were still saying it. They also disavowed their 2022 party guidebook that claimed international Jewish finance was a force that was a threat to Japan. They've changed it to the globalists, which is, of course, a term that's very commonly used in English language to refer to this conspiracy of highly rich people who are trying to take over the world, but is in some ways based on older anti-Semitic theories. And so they have spread these theories, but during the election, they didn't talk so much about these conspiracy theories. Instead, they tried to appeal to a wider audience by talking about Japanese people first and the misconception that foreigners are benefiting from Japan's social welfare system, that foreigners are causing a huge increase in crime, which simply is not true.
I mean, we can also look at the rise of the far right and their anti-immigration platform in Europe. Think of Hungary or the AfD in Germany. But is there a thematic thread that ultimately had an impact on Japan and gave rise to San Saito? Or is the populist trend in Japan kind of its own autonomous development?
The populist trend in other countries against immigration was certainly influential in that parties like San Saito and social media personalities who supported San Saito would translate and share videos showing the migrant crisis in other countries. And they created this view that even though Japan has a very small immigrant population, only about 3% of the country is foreign, they have created a perception across society that they're being flooded with foreigners in this country. And we have to stop them before we become like Europe or America.
Japan is seen as a homogenous and an aging society. I mean, immigration must be central to the political conversation, right?
Well, the ruling Liberal Democratic Party has bowed to business demands for labor and weakened the immigration controls over the last 10 years. Under Prime Minister Abe, they made significant changes that allowed a lot of workers and students to come in the country, and many of them ultimately stay here. The numbers have been nowhere near enough to overcome the declining birth rate, but they still have been increasing every year. And together with this, there has been a large increase in tourism, also at the impetus of the government, which really wanted tourism to improve the economy. And so although the number of foreign residents is relatively small, the number of tourists is huge. Mm. This has added to an overall anti-foreign feeling in Japan because people feel like their cities are being taken over by tourists.
That's really interesting. Well, 14 seats is still a small slice of Japan's nearly 250-seat parliament. What kind of influence could San Saito realistically wield going forward?
Well, I mean, by having 14 new seats, bring their total to 15 in the upper house. Upper house members in Japan, the equivalent of a U.S. senator, have six-year terms. So for the next 6 years, these politicians will be on the national stage and they will be able to say extreme things, whether it be about immigration or about foreigners or about Japan's wartime history. They have been shifting the narrative in Japan in a way that future politicians can take advantage of this and say the same kind of messages that they are saying now.
Jeffrey Hall teaches at Kanda University of International Studies, just outside Tokyo.
The Xinjiang region in western China has become known for the oppression of Uyghurs and other Muslim groups. But just over the border in Kazakhstan, hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs live freely. Reporting from Kazakhstan, Levi Bridges takes us inside a Uyghur community that is flourishing next door.
Recently, I got invited to a Uyghur wedding reception in Almaty, Kazakhstan's largest city. The happy couple went all out, rented a huge banquet hall, hired a dance troupe, and an ensemble of Uyghur musicians who play traditional instruments. The band's leader, Nazim Abdrimov, grew up in Kazakhstan. As a teenager, he remembers seeing Uyghur musicians on a trip to China.
Playing nonstop for 3-4 hours. And I was like under hypnosis.
Hypnosis,
yeah. It was really like touched me inside.
Abdrimov's parents pushed him to study science, something practical. But a university professor told him, as a Uyghur, he would never make it, a stereotype faced by ethnic minorities.
He said, you are Uyghur, you will not educated well, you will go to cafe to pull noodles.
Uyghurs face discrimination, even though they're one of the largest ethnic groups in Kazakhstan. Uyghurs have lived here for more than a century. Before the repression started in China, Abdrimov traveled to Xinjiang, the center of Uyghur culture, to learn about traditional music. And he eventually received the ultimate compliment about his music from Uyghurs in Kazakhstan.
They said, wow, you do it exactly like in our motherland.
Now, Almaty has become a kind of surrogate cultural capital for Uyghurs. The Kazakh government supports Uyghur language schools here and helps run the world's only Uyghur theater. Kazakhstan is also a majority Muslim country. So unlike China, Uyghur religious practices aren't restricted. At a Uyghur mosque I visit in Almaty, they're doing renovations, sprucing it up for the faithful. And there's the delicious food. In an Almaty restaurant, I meet Rustam Kariev, deputy chairman of the city's Uyghur Culture Center. He says, try the Uyghur tea. It's served with sour cream and plenty of salt.
Mmm, wow.
I dig into a spicy noodle dish called lagman as Kariev explains that some Uyghur dishes acquired Chinese names over time. He says it's kind of like the U.S.-Mexico border. Lots of culinary fusion happening. Kariev says no matter how popular tacos get in the U.S., everyone knows that's Mexican food. It's the same here for Uyghur dishes. At the city's Uyghur market, traditional drums hang next to these embroidered, kind of square-shaped, four-sided hats. Said Maximov, a local Kazakh Uyghur, says sometimes images on these hats signify the marital status of a man's children.
So you could see from far away, say, oh, this guy has 3 sons, and they are not married. Let's talk about it.
It helped with matchmaking back in the day. Uyghurs have always been a minority in the distant outskirts of empires founded by Russia and China. Maximov says Uyghurs are a tight-knit community that helps each other. They regularly hold large assemblies, for example, deciding how to help the needy.
We just show that collectively they can solve almost any issue.
It sounds very democratic.
Yeah, it really sounds like democratic. And maybe this is the reason why our neighbors, like China and Russia, they try to break us down.
Some Uyghurs, like Maximov, are getting tired of being known to the world simply as a persecuted Muslim minority. For him, Uyghur traditions form a modern, vibrant culture.
It's like a real brotherhood, which is beautiful because it's a very special bond when you're going through the difficulties, through the struggles with each other.
But Islam is still a cultural bedrock for many. Kahraman Jemberti is an Almaty native with the World Uyghur Congress.
Народ Уйгур объединяется именно под исламом.
He says Islam gives Uyghurs a common identity that unites them in their struggle for freedom and independence. Back at the wedding, the bride and groom roll up in a huge SUV limo with tinted windows. The party's finally getting started. Just over the border in China, these kinds of cultural and religious celebrations are essentially banned. But here, in this thriving community in Kazakhstan, they haven't been erased. For The World, I'm Levi Bridges, Almaty, Kazakhstan.
This is The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Global vaccine rates have gone up dramatically in the past 50 years. That's helped stop the spread of deadly diseases like measles, polio, diphtheria, and whooping cough. But now global vaccine rates are stalling, and in some cases they are in steep decline, putting all that progress at risk. Dr. Peter Hotez is a pediatrician and vaccine researcher at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston. I asked him to describe that decline in vaccine rates and just how steep it is.
Well, I think the decline itself is not so steep. It's just that it's going in the wrong direction. And that's what really worries me. We've had more than 20 plus years of steady increases in our ability to vaccinate the world's children. And this is the product of the Gavi Alliance, the Global Alliance of Vaccines and Immunizations, that's brought down under 5 childhood deaths from measles, more than 90%, and similar improvements in deaths from whooping cough and diphtheria and Hib meningitis and others, and now in starting to slow, plateau, or in some cases go in the wrong direction.
So what are the main drivers of this decline that we're seeing in vaccination rates?
I think there are two drivers. One, I think there's the social disruption of the COVID pandemic that in some cases interrupted vaccination programs. In others, the diversion of resources. But I think the more troubling one is rise in anti-vaccine activism, particularly what I worry about is the globalization of anti-vaccine activism that's steeply rising in the United States. And now this is starting to contaminate low and middle income countries in Latin America, on the African continent, and elsewhere.
Can you give me some examples of what that looks like in Latin America and Africa?
Yeah, sure. So in Latin America, I'm here at Texas Children's Hospital, where we have a very good relationship with the Latin American pediatric societies in Mexico and Colombia and Central American countries and in Brazil. And for years, I would go there and speak and congratulate the pediatricians on holding back rising anti-vaccine activism in the U.S. from affecting their countries. Now that's starting to falter and break down, and pediatricians are telling me some of the same rhetoric that we're hearing about on podcasts and in some of the cable news channels in the U.S. is now starting to filter to Latin America. And we've seen this now on the African continent. I wrote about it in my 2023 book, The Deadly Rise of Anti-Science, how some of that same anti-vaccine rhetoric that's been pushed by the nighttime Fox News anchors is now showing up on the African continent.
And like in the U.S., in some cases, Brazil, for example, some of this vaccine skepticism or hesitancy is coming from very high up. I understand that Bolsonaro, the former president of Brazil, tried to push legislation that would require a prescription for standard childhood vaccinations and has spread falsehoods about what the COVID vaccine could potentially do to folks.
That's right. And he himself had publicly refused to get vaccinated. So what you're starting to see, particularly in authoritarian regimes, is they're adopting anti-vaccine activism as part of the canon of beliefs.
Why? Why do you think authoritarian governments are latching onto this idea specifically?
The short answer is, I don't know. But the longer answer is, we've seen this before. You know, when we look at the history of Stalinist Russia, right? They targeted science and scientists for purposes of political control. And we even saw that in Weimar Germany. So starting in the 20th century, targeting mainstream science, especially biomedical science, and scientists, and portraying them as public enemies or cartoon villains, kind of became a signature of authoritarianism.
What's that second strand you mentioned?
The second strand is the rise of the wellness and influencer industry, which has become very lucrative and unfortunately very corrupt. And part of the business case for the wellness and influencer industry is what generic medications they can buy in bulk and then jack up the price, and then they'll pair it with a telehealth visit. And a lot of those drugs are low-cost generic antiparasitic drugs, such as ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, or fenbendazole. And guess what? That's what's being pushed, for instance, as an alternative to COVID. We've even heard it false claims that it could be used for cancer. It doesn't help any of those things. But this has become now a major business line of the health and wellness influencer industry. It's very corrupt.
So we also are seeing a drop or decline in vaccine funding. The Trump administration wants to withhold the $1.6 billion that the Biden administration had pledged to Gavi, the vaccine alliance that helps get vaccines to children in the world's poorest countries that you've mentioned already. What difference will that make?
Well, you know, this is especially tragic because Gavi is probably, in my view, one of the single most successful and cost-effective public health initiatives the world has ever seen. It began in 2000. It's a partnership with industry, academic partners, civil society. It brings in the Gates Foundation, and it was designed to accelerate our ability to vaccinate the world's children with pediatric vaccines and also develop some new vaccines. And boy, what a success story that's been. We've seen, 75 to 90% decrease in under five childhood deaths globally at a very modest cost. So in terms of cost effectiveness, I can't imagine anything more significant. Inexplicably, the Trump administration has decided to pull its funding. The U.S. government was one of the larger funders for the Gavi Alliance. I think it provides annually about 15% of the funding.
Yeah, I have the figure of 13%, yeah.
13%. Yeah, it's just going to make it harder for us to continue those success stories. This is not the kind of thing that you want to pull the plug on.
13%, 15% of funding. Will other countries just step up and make up that difference? You know, it's significant, but not a huge portion of the budget.
The answer is, I don't think we know. Will the other G20 nations now step up? Will there be an acceleration in private funding support? This is a global resource for helping the world's poorest children. And by the way, by vaccinating them and preventing kids from getting sick and keeping parents also in the workforce, it has a big economic impact as well. So remember, these diseases not only affect public health, they affect economic development. And so this is a low-cost way to lift people out of poverty.
Do you see any openings in the discussion, the anti-vax discussion globally?
Well, that's a good question. As I say, anti-vaccine activism doesn't necessarily come in the same flavor in different countries, but increasingly now it's that U.S. style linked to the wellness influencer industry and health freedom, medical freedom, libertarian philosophies that you're starting to see contaminate other countries. So getting ready, having elected leaders in those countries get ready for the onslaught of disinformation and reminding them that they shouldn't want to see what has happened in the U.S. and their countries happen as well.
Dr. Peter Hotez is a pediatrician and vaccine researcher at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston. He's been speaking with us about declining global vaccination rates. Dr. Hotez, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
More global stories are coming your way. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Climate change is transforming our world and our lives at a pace that can feel scary.
It's fueling disasters that are causing increased devastation, flooding, heat waves, and fires. The cost of that destruction is expected to reach at least $38 trillion annually by 2050.
$38 trillion per year. Our partners at Deutsche Welle, DW, have been talking about that massive cost on their Living Planet podcast.
And we'll be listening to parts of a few of their episodes on our show this week, starting today.
Sam Baker is a DW producer in Cologne, Germany. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So that number I just mentioned, $38 trillion every year, that is a lot of money. How is that figure actually calculated?
So this comes from the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, and they looked at how much damages and lost income are going to cost based on our emissions that we have already released. And it looks at how an increase in temperature and a change in rainfall patterns will affect our economies, our livelihoods, you know, droughts, floods, those sorts of things. However, it did not take into account certain climate disasters like forest fires and rising sea levels. So that's why we say at least $38 trillion per year, and at least because we're still emitting more greenhouse gases. So this number is likely to be much, much higher even.
So talk to us about some of the different approaches countries are trying to wrangle to deal with all of this.
So there's basically two approaches. Either you can offer incentives, things like giving people rebates on electric vehicles or tax breaks to install a heat pump and switch over from an old oil and gas boiler. But then on the other side, you have sticks, so disincentives or requirements that people have to do to try and reduce their emissions. So this can be a price or a tax on carbon. It can also be something called a cap and trade system.
You're going to explain all that in today's episode, in which we take listeners to Canada, where the government's made big strides in the direction of those sticks you were talking about, or requirements. What are they doing?
So in Canada, they actually put a price on each ton of CO2. So this was both a consumer and an industrial price for emitting carbon dioxide. And that was done by former Environment Minister Catherine McKenna, who I spoke to for this episode.
I'm Catherine McKenna. I am the principal and founder of Climate and Nature Solutions. I am a recovering politician, former Minister of Environment and Climate Change, as well as Minister of Infrastructure for Canada.
Catherine McKenna served in Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government. And just days after being named Environment Minister in 2015, she was sent to Paris to work on the landmark climate deal. Nations came together in creating the Paris Agreement and pledged to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by enough to keep global warming well below a 2-degree increase from pre-industrial levels. But after the Paris Agreement was finished and signed, Catherine had to return home and help Canada deliver on their promised emissions reductions. She was tasked with putting a price on carbon pollution for both heavy emitters and consumers.
Well, when I came in, we had 80% of Canadians living in a jurisdiction where there was a price on carbon pollution. And if you're going to try to do something in a federation, there has to be a principle of fairness. So we decided that we would have a price on pollution that would start at $10 and go up to $50. This was the consumer price.
So a quick explanation on two important concepts when talking about the stick of pricing CO2 emissions. There are basically two options. The first is a cap and trade system. In this setup, there's a cap on how much can be emitted, and that keeps getting ratcheted down over time. If you're a company that wants to delay reducing your emissions, you can buy allowances or permits in order to emit more. The supply and demand of these allowances sets the price. So that price will continue to go up as fewer allowances are available. The idea is that companies have a strong incentive to save money by cutting their emissions and even selling their allowances if they decarbonize faster than others. Now, the other option is a carbon tax. This is where you simply put a direct price on each ton of CO2 emitted, and then the company emitting that carbon, or the consumer at the gas pump or heating their home, they pay that price. In both systems, there's a price for emissions. Canada went with the second option. For consumers, that meant paying an added $10 per ton of CO2 emitted, with that number set to go up each year until it reached $50 per ton. Though, as Catherine is quick to point out, theirs wasn't technically a tax, because the government didn't keep the money.
When I was trying to figure this out, it was a conservative prime minister, Brian Mulroney, who actually supported it. He said, yes, you've got to use the market. It's the smartest way. When I worked with George Bush and Ronald Reagan on acid rain, we looked at how we could put a price to create the incentive for industry to act. So I was like, great. He said, go talk to George Shultz, a lovely Republican who was Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan. He said to me, okay, Catherine, you must return the revenues. You must give it all back in a transparent way. And I was like, oh, that's smart. And then I had conservative premier in Quebec who supported it because he had established a cap and trade system. I had a conservative premier in British Columbia who had brought in a direct price. So I felt like I had done everything, including with like conservative dudes to like get people on side.
These two systems, cap and trade and carbon pricing, were until more recently many conservative politicians' preferred answer to addressing climate change, precisely because they are market-based solutions. In Canada, this price on carbon pollution returned the money to citizens, at first through their tax refunds.
But the problem is there's so much going on when you file your taxes. When you get a rebate, it's not directly related. Like, people weren't directly relating it. So I was very not happy about that situation.
But people were noticing it when they filled up their cars or looked at their energy bills.
So that's obviously very tricky because people are very price sensitive. Like, people will travel like kilometers for a penny on their gas.
After COVID hit, the government realized that they could send checks to people. So they started giving people the money back that way. Even still, Catherine says explaining the new pollution pricing was a struggle.
It's interesting because we did go through different iterations of how to talk about a price on pollution. So we started with a carbon tax because we didn't know exactly how we were going to design it. That polls terribly. So free advice to anyone doing it, don't call it carbon tax. Then we did carbon pricing. And then people are like, what is carbon pricing? They kind of got it, but still not that popular. Then you did a price on pollution, much more popular. But the best way to describe it, honestly, is the way you would go in. If you go into a classroom of grade 4 students, which I would do, I'd say, do you think it should be free to pollute? They'd be like, no, no. And so, like, then you kind of are winning when you say, like, it cannot be free to pollute. There's a cost. Everyone kind of understands that, even if you're a grade 4 student. And so I just think that if you're going to do it, you have to sell it. You have to advertise it. You have to talk about it. And you have to see it as a winning issue, not an issue you're hiding from. Because I think at the end, liberals were like, oh, we don't want to talk about this. This seems kind of hard. We're kind of learning the well. You do that, you're basically giving the floor to folks that are just lying about what it's doing and have no plan.
The Liberal Party did manage to win two elections defending their price on pollution. But Catherine also faced setbacks, including strong opposition from industry, online disinformation campaigns, and personal attacks. She even needed security at one point.
That's Sam Baker, who reported on the cost of climate for the Living Planet podcast from our partners at DW, Deutsche Welle. Sam is here with me again. And Sam, a lot has happened in Canada since the work on that carbon tax we just heard about. As of this March, the country has a new prime minister, Mark Carney. Has that new leadership changed the playing field?
Yes, it has, which is perhaps a little surprising because he's long been considered quite a climate advocate. But actually, the first thing he did as prime minister was scrap that consumer price on carbon. And he did that because it was extremely unpopular in Canada, and he was very close to an election, so having to run again to hold on to being prime minister there.
How did Catherine McKenna respond to that, though?
She understood that the politics are what they are, but she also said, and she told me that she had spoken to him about this, that big polluters, the industry, they really needed to pay. So that industrial price shouldn't go away, and it should be used to pay for other things, for incentives for Canadians to make more climate-friendly choices.
Sam, our next conversation with DW takes us to a giant kelp forest. Why that matters when it comes to the cost of climate change, we'll tune in tomorrow for that. That's Sam Baker of DW Deutsche Welle. We've been talking about the Living Planet podcast. You can hear the full episode online or wherever you get your podcasts. Sam, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
There is a lot of very serious news happening across the world. We report on a lot of it, but there is also plenty that'll make you laugh. This ad campaign from New Zealand caught our eye today.
Once upon a time, the world wanted to be New Zealand. We had the clean green image, the Earth's sexiest accent. Everyone wanted a slice of our pie. But now look at us.
It has the look and feel of a tourism campaign, but the message is unconventional.
We need something new to be proud of, something big and brave to put us back on the map. It's time for New Zealand to become the best place in the world to have herpes.
Yep, you were not mistaken. New Zealand wants to be the best place in the world to have herpes.
This tongue-in-cheek public health campaign is using humor to destigmatize a condition that affects 3.7 billion people under the age of 50. The ads highlight New Zealand's natural beauty, but then steer viewers toward an online education course with short informational videos about the virus.
The educational content series features iconic Kiwis, with each lesson breaking down an aspect of herpes stigma.
To make New Zealand the most herpes-friendly country in the world.
Most New Zealanders with the virus that causes herpes do not have symptoms. That's according to the New Zealand Herpes Foundation. Even so, health officials say a herpes diagnosis tends to have a negative impact on mental health, and that's why the campaign is trying to lighten things up. The New Zealand Herpes Foundation says millions of people have seen the ads, and it's made a massive difference.
New Zealand, we are officially the best place in the world to have herpes.
You can check out the ad campaign at thebestplaceintheworldtohaveherpes.com. Dare we say it's going viral?
Yeah, fair. Mexican musician Natalia Lafourcade was on the U.S. leg of her new tour this past spring when one of her older songs became an unofficial anthem at immigrant rights protests in Los Angeles. In city after city across the U.S., a singer-songwriter played to full houses, and the fact that her fan base turned out for shows despite fears of immigration enforcement, that meant a lot to Lafourcade. The world's Tibi Saizea caught up with her in Mexico City.
Natalia Lafourcade didn't expect that one of her most famous songs would take on new meaning during a time of protest. She wrote Hasta la Raíz, or Down to the Root, nearly a decade ago. It's a song about holding on to your heritage even when life takes you far from home. And this summer, it became an anthem at protests in Los Angeles against immigration raids.
You never know how a song can be so important for somebody, you know?
Her voice resonated with many Mexican immigrants facing questions about identity and belonging.
My name is Jesus Garcia. I've been a Mexican immigrant in the United States for 16 years already.
Garcia has been a fan of Natalia Lafourcade for two decades, but he says that particular song hit differently this year.
It is a song about our roots, our memories, our origin. I think this song lately becomes a collective embrace. It could be taken like an act of affirmation and dignity.
During her tour, Natalia Lafourcade was concerned about safety for her band, but especially for her public. She worried immigration raids could target people going to her shows.
In one side, we said, like, shall we go back home? Is this dangerous for us to be here?
But people did show up. Many concerts were sold out.
We were watching right at the moment so many people coming to the show, taking the risk, you know, to go out from their houses without knowing if it was going to be too much risk because something could have happened, you know, even for us.
She says those shows became a special place for people to connect.
And then I realized the importance of music and to be able to share it. And I felt so proud of being Mexican and to perceive people's dignity about their roots and their culture. That was very emotive. It becomes a healing moment, you know?
Her older songs still resonate. But Lafourcade is also sharing something new. Her latest album is called Cancionera, or Songbook, and she wrote it right before she turned 40.
Cancionera, no dejes de sorprenderme.
Whenever you enter a different decade, I guess we all question, is everything okay? Am I happy? Am I in a good place? Do I want to keep going the way I'm doing?
Cancionera, devuélveme aquella primavera.
She recorded it live with her full band in the studio and in one take, no cuts. She wanted it to feel honest and real.
I think Cancionera became like a message, you know, to keep going, to make that a strong connection to my true self and not to be afraid of just being.
And as with much of her work, this album draws from traditional Mexican sounds.
Venga ya la vida, yay! Saluda la sirena.
She says her everyday life in her native Veracruz, the people, the music, the rituals, all shape her new album.
The lyrics, the stories behind the lyrics reflect all the things that made me proud of my culture, my roots, my country, my family.
She comes back to the U.S. in September for the second leg of her tour. She'll be performing across the West Coast, and more dates on the East Coast are planned for next year. She hopes that concertgoers can put aside whatever is going on in their lives and just focus on the music for a few hours.
I always say that music has this special thing about bringing people together and throwing down any wall. Then you come with the music and it's just about opening the heart and connecting through the soul.
Llegaste a su vida, palomo, llamando a la puerta. Los ángeles desde los cielos lo hicieron pasar.
For the world, I'm TV Saicea, Mexico City.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. China has started building what's expected to be the biggest hydroelectric dam on Earth. The dam is designed to generate as much as 300 billion kilowatt hours of electricity each year by blocking a portion of the Yarlung Tsangpo in Tibet. To put that in perspective, that's the same amount of electricity used across the entire United Kingdom last year. The dam will take about a decade to build and cost $167 billion. It is a huge investment at a time when geopolitical tensions over water security and renewable energy are sky high. Scott Moore can speak to both issues. He's director of China programs at the University of Pennsylvania, and he told us that hydropower is a critical piece of China's energy infrastructure.
It is the largest source of non-fossil energy generation in China's mix, so this is a really significant addition to China's power supply.
So tell me more about why China is building a dam of this size in this particular location.
Because of the amount of energy that's generated from the river flowing at this particular spot, it's just a feature of the particular geography and topography of the area that there's a lot of energy being generated by the water flowing very quickly as it descends from the steep Himalayan mountain region, cutting a course through the Himalayan plateau before it eventually empties out.
Big, huge infrastructure projects like this one are often controversial, and this is no exception. What is the controversy surrounding this dam?
Couple of things. Probably the biggest is geopolitical. China and India have long had a lot of tensions over transboundary rivers. And I at least interpret the roots of that in the boundary and territorial disputes that China and India have long had over parts of the Himalayan region. There is also an environmental dimension. This is a very remote part of the world, very sparsely settled, ecologically quite fragile. And so there are some significant environmental impacts that could be that could be expected as a result of construction of this dam.
And this is going to be built or is starting to be built in Tibet, a semi-autonomous region in China. Is that also a concern?
Yes, that could also be a concern related to disruptions to traditional ways of life in the Tibetan region.
China, of course, as you have mentioned, has a history of these big dam building projects. I think a lot of people might remember China's Three Gorges Dam, which is currently the biggest source of non-fossil fuel energy in the world. And it, too, was highly controversial when it got underway in the 90s. I'm curious if that project, how it was done, how it was received, has influenced how the Chinese government approached this project.
Almost certainly in the sense that it did provide a template for kind of large hydropower dam, really mega dam construction. Also, there's a little bit of a parallel in terms of the social impact of the Three Gorges Dam. Frankly, probably quite a bit larger than those that will be caused by this dam, just because the Three Gorges Dam was built in a much more populated area.
Okay, yeah, that was a big part of it. The Three Gorges displaced a lot of people. This one, you're saying, is displacing fewer?
Fewer. I mean, again, I don't want to understate the potential disruption to traditional ways of life and the people who do live in this region, but it's a very sparsely populated region.
Mm. So this is a domestic project, but China has also been investing in hydropower elsewhere. How does this dam fit into China's larger energy vision?
Well, despite the rapid growth of wind, solar energy in China, hydropower does still account for the single greatest share of non-fossil energy generation in China's energy mix. And hydropower in general does have some advantages. Once it's built, it's a very low carbon source of electricity, tends to be fairly inexpensive, and so it can be very good for stimulating the growth of things like light industry, for example. At the same time, there is kind of a looming issue related to climate change in this region, in that the Yarlung Tsangpo is fed primarily by glacial and snowmelt in the high Himalayan region that is melting as a result of warming temperatures. In the short term, meaning for the next few decades, really sort of getting out towards the 2080s or so, the flow of that glacier and snowmelt will increase. So the volume of water that's going to be, you know, running through the river is going to be increasing in for the next few decades and generating more hydropower. After that, however, the flow is going to significantly decrease. And so the generation potential of this dam is almost certainly going to decline over time.
China has so much hydropower. Is that true across a lot of these dams? I mean, I'm wondering what the larger climate impact on China's hydropower will be.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on, you know, sort of basin to basin.
Right.
So in the Yangtze, for example, where Three Gorges is, generally speaking, there's been a trend toward heavier precipitation. But it, as a general rule, one of the sort of downsides of hydropower is that it is quite climate sensitive relative to other forms of generation.
Scott Moore joined us from the University of Pennsylvania, where he directs the China programs.
Finally today, accordion aficionados are rejoicing. The world's largest known private collection of accordions has gone up for auction. We're talking 750 of them in all shapes and sizes, some of them dating back to the 19th century.
The accordions, affectionately called squeeze boxes, belonged to an Irishman named Ken Hopkins. In some circles, Hopkins was known as the accordion man. He began playing the instrument as a child and later became a prolific performer, earning reputation as a master of the instrument in a number of bands. Along the way, he acquired a huge personal collection of accordions.
By the time Hopkins died last year, every room of his house was filled with accordions. 5 truckloads of them, to be exact. That's what it took to move the collection to the auction house. The going estimate for how much the collection is likely to fetch at auction, $300,000. A wealth of accordions, it could say.
A Irish musician Sharon Shannon taking her button accordion for a ride there on a tune called Timbuktu. And that is where we leave you today. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego.
You can find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. Search for us at The World News GBH. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us same time, same place tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Mary Elizabeth Alexander, Nicole and David Berger, Dan Shee and Ted McGovern, Anne and John Newman, and Lawrence Wilkinson. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.